Our next presentation is from Dr. Stephen Predmore. We're very honoured. He's the Vice President and Chief Safety Officer from JetBlue Airlines, and he'll be presenting the next paper.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back okay? Great. All right, we'll get settled in. Everyone's had a nice lunch. We've got the lights down. We're going to warm up the room a little bit. I learned early in my human factors training that people don't fall asleep because they're bored or because they don't care, or fall asleep because they're sleepy. So this is actually one meeting where, you know what, if you go to sleep, you go to sleep, and that's perfectly fine. You obviously need to do it. Just if you're a noisy sleeper, we may have to ask you to leave. Before I start my remarks, let me first say thanks to Rick Haybrook and the Human Factors Committee, as well as the RSSB, for the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with you today, share some thoughts about human factors training and safety management systems and so forth. I've been doing this long enough now that I don't generally get too anxious about these things, but I got a fair amount of anxiety about this particular presentation. And sort of thinking through it, my anxiety is kind of on three levels. The first is, you know, as an American, anything with royal in front of it is really intimidating. And as I was getting ready to leave New York, I was talking to my six-year-old daughter, and she said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to London for a business meeting." And she goes, "Well, where's the meeting?" And I said, "It's the Royal Aeronautical Society." And she said, "Royal?" "Will the Queen be there?" And I said, "Probably not. She's a pretty busy lady." And she goes, "Well, if she is, will you get her autograph?" So I said, "Yeah, we'll see what we can do." So, second level of anxiety really has to do with the last two times I've been to London, and I haven't been here in quite some time. In fact, I think it's been about 10 years. But the last two times I've been in London, the days that I've been here, I've experienced a major rail accident. 1999 in October with the Paddington crash, obviously a tragic event. And then again in October of 2000, I think it was at Hatfield, resulted in the death of four folks. So, my wife, who was with me on both trips, reminded me of that and said, "You know, maybe it's not such a good idea. You seem to be bad luck." I said, "Well, so are you." So she's at home in New York. Won't be here today. So hopefully, so far, so good, right? I'm sure a lot of pagers will go off if things change. So. And the third, we really had to kind of do with the provisional title for my talk that Rick offered up, which was really about, I think in human factors, training reduce headcount. And my anxiety there was really about, would my CFO see that? Because, the chief financial officer sees me talking about that, I'm sure we'll have a meeting, and the potential for budget cuts or staffing cuts looms large. But I decided not to talk about that, not because I didn't want to tackle the issue, but I think the short answer is you're going to be hard-pressed to say you can reduce headcount as a result of human factors training. But I do want to talk about sort of maximizing the effectiveness of your human factors training. And a lot of it has already been discussed today in terms of kind of where we are with human factors training and the evolution of it, specifically CRM to threat and air management. But then how it fits into an overall safety management system. And, in that way, you're really able, I think, to provide much more effective training as part of your overall SMS. So let's just step back first to, I should do this as well, because it occurred to me, I kind of put this together at the last minute. Many of you probably aren't familiar with JetBlue. We've been in our almost 10 years now, primarily a domestic operator in the U.S. Started operations in February of 2000 with the mission to bring humanity back to air travel. I think as you're well aware, the level of customer service in the airline industry really was pretty much at an all-time low, and the thought was, well, let's just, let's create not an airline, but a customer service company that really just treats people well. Just be nice to them, and they'll come back. And it's worked fairly well for us so far. We've got now about 11,500 crew members, and we don't use the term employee at JetBlue. We refer to everybody as a crew member. So 11,500 crew members, about 600 flights daily. Our main base of operations is at JFK. We'll talk a little bit about the challenges that that creates for us. We're primarily an O&D carrier, origination, destination, direct point-to-point operator. We have what we call focus cities, not sort of traditional hubs, but they're in JFK, Boston, Long Beach, Fort Lauderdale, and Orlando. Overall, we serve about 53 cities. I put about because we just recently announced more. And they're all of our destinations right now are in the Americas, either North, South, or Central America, excuse me, in the Caribbean. Excuse me, we currently operate 149 aircraft, 41 Embraer E190s. We were the launch customer on the E190. I know we saw the Flybe presentation earlier. They were the launch on the 195s. And 108 Airbus A320s. I mentioned our business model. We're a low-cost carrier, try to maintain strict cost control and have been fairly successful at that. But really reference ourselves as a value-oriented carrier. We provide a single class of service, but the largest leg room in the U.S. for a coach product, leather seats, free live TV and satellite radio in every seat. And so I think a quality product in terms of the equipment, but really I think what distinguishes us from most of our competition is the level of customer service we provide. We put a tremendous amount of energy around hiring and selecting the right people who want to serve customers. And I'll just note also, because it comes into play as we talk about some voluntary programs, that right now we are a non-union carrier. We have no unions represented within our workforce, and that creates some interesting questions when you start talking about safety programs and representation for employees and so forth. So this very quickly, this is our route map. You can see we are heavily concentrated in the Northeast, the Caribbean, and Florida, and then on the West Coast of the U.S. Okay. Let's step back for a second, go back about 25 years or so, 25 to 30 years, and talk about sort of the origins of human factors training. And of course, the initial evolution of this was cockpit resource management, which at the time was heavily, almost exclusively pilot-centric. It was about the pilot and pilot performance. The training itself, the content of the training was really around concepts of CRM, so concepts like communication and coordination, situational awareness, and so forth, really making people aware of these types of soft skills, but also a heavy dose of psychology and emphasis on psychological factors like attitudes and personalities, and a lot of discussion in those days about what makes the right type of pilot. Is the right stuff really the right stuff for pilots? So a lot of psychologists getting together and having a lot of meetings and talking. And, I think some of it was really great. We had to sort of go through parts of this evolution, I think, but the translation to the standard average line operational pilot was difficult sometimes at best. A lot of focus on the social dynamics in the cockpit, obviously, as well, in terms of how the crew worked together. But again, from a human factors perspective, really it was a training solution. We knew what many of the issues were, and the immediate solution was training. The business case for the training is very expensive. Business case was pretty obvious, though. String of catastrophic accidents, an accident rate was unacceptable by any standard, and the realization that as traffic grew, if that rate stayed the same, we are looking at an absolutely unacceptable number of accidents by anybody's standard. So the business case was fairly straightforward. It was to avoid major accidents, and which are extraordinarily expensive. And so, it was kind of a no-brainer, I think. And then we moved into crew resource management, where we started looking at the crew dynamics outside the cockpit or moving beyond the cockpit, and started to, realize pretty quickly, flight crew deals with cabin crew on a regular basis, air traffic, maintenance, dispatch, other areas outside. So the crew dynamics it very quickly moved outside the cockpit, but still a focus on flight crew interactions with those operating areas, at least initially. and the performance of the flight crew. So what impact do the interactions with the cabin have on flight crew performance in the cockpit or with air traffic control? But still, you know, very heavy reliance on training solutions here. It starts to evolve over time, but still we're talking largely about training. The business case, you know, again, focus on accidents, but we also start recognizing, you know, the incidents are pretty expensive too, and particularly as you start talking about ground damages and injuries and other sorts of things that happen. You know, again, business case, fairly straightforward, you know, lots of dollars involved. Most recent evolution, of course, and we've talked about it throughout the day, and there'll be, I think, some more discussion about it, threat and air management, which looks at the entire operational and safety environment that our crews operate in and what resources are available now within that operating environment, as well as what barriers are in place to prevent adverse outcomes. And you know, again, we'll go into a little more detail around that. But for the first time, we're looking at the whole environment, not just necessarily the performance of the crew in that environment. And it provides an opportunity really to systematically measure what that environment looks like and how crews operate within it, and provides a nice model for some structured observation and assessment, which goes under the term LOSA, and I'll talk more about that, but line operational safety audits. The business case, at least as we've sort of worked it within JetBlue and I think many parts of the U.S., is really around, again, threat and air management, part of the safety management system, is really around applying quality management standards to safety and operational reliability. So by applying those principles, you're improving safety and efficiency and reliability through quality improvements. And so as we look at the training, we'll go into this, you know, really the types of skills and the concepts that you're teaching through threat and air management apply to more than just operational safety. Here's the basic threat and air model that we use at JetBlue, and again, you know, also I should say part of my anxiety was putting a Swiss cheese model up here with Jim Reason in the room, because, you know, you just sort of expect, it's brilliant, Steve, but you've screwed it all up. But here's the model that we use in the threat and air management training that we provide to our flight crews and into our cabin, which, you know, obviously you have threats, and you've got the barriers represented as the slices of Swiss cheese. Some barriers are designed to prevent errors and prevent you know, problems such as your process, your SOPs, regulations, some of your training. Other barriers are, but nevertheless, errors occur, we know that. Other barriers are then designed to help us to trap those errors when they do occur so that we don't see adverse outcomes or undesired aircraft states. Nevertheless, that does happen, and some errors aren't trapped, and as a result, we find the aircraft in a position that we don't want it to be in. And so the focus there with the barriers is really on mitigating the outcomes of that risk and those hazards. And then obviously, if all of those fail, you can have a much more serious outcome. We always have a slide that includes the last slice of cheese, which is luck. And you know, that comes into play in many circumstances, but it's a very porous barrier, obviously. Another shot of the types of defenses, and we talk through these. Again, you've got everything from the hardware, the aircraft and the systems on board, the SOPs, and so forth. And we talk with our pilots about the fact that some defenses are given to you, and that's your processes, that's your procedures, your training, some of your training, et cetera, the people that you have as resources, and some defenses that we expect them to provide. And so as we educate them through some of these skills and that, we expect them to show up at the aircraft fit with, you know, this sort of toolbox available to them, system, should the other barriers not work. And we talk a lot about how the defenses in place are enhanced through the training programs. Flight training. So flight training, you know, it strengthens the barriers around SOPs. SOPs are just words in a book until we train them and check them. Flows and checklists the same way, and then flying skills, just getting out and practicing. CRM training, and largely here we're talking about joint training between the flight crew and the cabin crew. We do CRM training, crew resource management training, jointly between those groups. and bring in dispatch as well. But again, impacts some of these barriers, strengthens some, builds others. And then finally, threat and air management training, which they get a full, I think it's a day and a half of, with our pilots anyway. And we build the threat and air management training around really building skill sets in these areas: communications and briefing, automation management, teamwork, time management, what if planning or contingency planning, and situational awareness. This is the skill set that we try to build through our threat and air management training with the crews. Give an example: communications. Okay, the specific skills that we target with our communications module is, you know, think out loud. Okay, don't sit there quietly and work through the scenarios in your head. Work through it out loud so that, you know, your co-pilot has an opportunity to participate as well. Might be thinking of something that you're not. If you are thinking about something, speak up. Don't keep it to yourself till it's too late. Ask questions. Ask a lot of questions. If you're wondering about something, ask. Don't assume that because you don't know, you're wrong, or it's not an issue, or it's not a factor. Raise it. And then through that, you maintain a better sense of situational awareness. We have a whole different module on situational awareness that we get into. Finally, be specific. Okay, avoid the hint and hope kind of messaging that happens. Those of you familiar with the Air Florida flight, you know, with the first officer who was extremely concerned about the ice buildup on the wings, but didn't come out and say that directly, kind of hinted around it until it was too late. Do you think this is going to work versus, you know, I'm showing you two dots high on the approach, get on the glide slope, or man, that's going to be tight versus, you know, that if we take this course of action, we're going to be on the ground with less than 4,000 pounds of fuel. Okay, be very, very specific in your remarks. So for each of those barriers, we work through a set of skills around those and train them pretty intensively with actual events from JetBlue experience as well as other airlines. Okay. The nice thing about the threat and air management model is that it translates really easily into any sort of domain of quality, whether it's operational reliability or efficiency or even customer service. And that's largely because all of those aspects of quality are subjected to environmental threats. There are things happening out there every day that impact customer service or our ability to be on time, as well as, you know, our safety performance. Additionally, when you step back and you think about it, again, human error is pervasive. There are humans behind the degree of quality we're delivering in any one of those domains. And you know, I've got this, in fact, we went through this exercise once where I asked our, you know, head of airports, I want you to list out the five worst stations from a reliability and customer service standpoint. And on a separate set of paper, I wrote out the five cities that, from my standpoint, from a safety perspective, were the worst cities. And four out of the five matched on both lists, because we got humans driving the processes in both cases, okay, whether it's, you know, not having the right training, whether it's not being a leader who's present in the operation, whether, you know, whatever the reasons might be, they tend to cross over those domains of quality. So we see a high degree of correlation between all of these dimensions of quality. So as we look at expanding the threat and air management model beyond what we provide to the flight crews, it's a fairly easy translation. These are the skill sets that we build around briefings. And so, first of all, brief the bottom lines. Set clear bottom lines on what actions will be taken. So in the flight domain, it's if we're still in this holding pattern with 6,000 pounds of fuel, we're going to divert. Setting a hard bottom line. Same with customer service. We're going to hold this flight for 25 minutes for connecting customers. If they're not here by then, we have to release the flight. So setting those bottom lines so that everybody's on the same page. Briefing the exceptions. What's different today than maybe the last time we did this? Okay, the first example again from the flight deck, you have an inoperative thrust reverser, you've got a potentially contaminated runway, you don't want to float the airplane, get it on the ground and be ready for some directional control issues, all right? The second example is one out of the maintenance world that we actually experienced, where they were doing a number of gear swings, primarily on the A320s, and we had an Embraer that required a gear swing. Same crew came in and installed the tail jack or tail support on the aircraft, which you don't do on an Embraer because it needs to be able to move up and down a little bit and crunch the tail on that. So again, seemed like straightforward, repetitive task, different aircraft, different task, and there was no briefing before. Brief contingency plans. If we have to go around, we'll turn left instead of right because of storms. A system operations area, you know, we just went through this pandemic exercise with the H1N1 virus and went through a lot of what-if scenarios. And one of the ones that we realized is that, you know, we've got to establish some way of, in New York, which has been, you know, one of the sort of epicenters of the H1N1 virus, a lot of schools closing. You know, so even if people aren't sick, their kids are home because the schools are closed, so they don't have daycare, so we had to start looking at what sorts of daycare options are available. So again, it's taking the same kinds of skills that we provide to our pilots and our in-flight crew members and really moving them through the entire enterprise, all operational areas. And it resonates very well with them. You know, that's what I love about threat and air management. It's not psychology, it's practical, it's reasonable. And it seems to resonate very, very well. Okay, let's talk a little bit about training limitations. You know, I think it's unquestioned that the human factors training, CRM, both cockpit and crew, over the course of the last 25 years has absolutely improved the safety of the system. To what degree is arguable or is debatable, certainly, but it has clearly had a positive impact. But we haven't seen, at least in the U.S., we have not seen the same level of institutionalizing human factors training in other domains as it is in the flight deck and now in flight as well. So why is that? And here are some of the reasons that, you know, I think attribute to that. First of all, you have a very structured training regime on the flight deck. Okay, pilots come back every year if they're required. They come back every 6 months, captains do, for a check ride. So you've got a very structured training regime. It's a matter of just getting the content in there, integrating it where you can with operational training and then maybe a little bit of additional focus training. But you've got an established training structure. You don't have that in every other area. We don't do recurrent training for our ground operations folks on a regular basis. Maintenance, we do some. In flight, we do it every 2 years, so we do have some opportunity there. But some of these areas, there's no recurrent training requirement, so you've got to create a new training program for them. Extraordinarily costly. The cost effectiveness isn't as clear in those other areas. Again, you don't have the major accident direct. You do around maintenance in some of these other areas, but it's not as clear a cost equation in some of the other areas. Turnover attrition rates. This is probably one of the biggest challenges that we have, particularly on the ground side. Some of our cities have 40, 60, we have one city has 80% annual turnover in terms of ground operations folks. So how much are you going to invest in training for folks that, you know, 80% of them are going to be gone in the course of the next year? So it's just not very cost effective from that standpoint as well. And then the last one is really about sort of the absence of champions in those areas in terms of, you know, sort of carrying the human factors banner outside of the flight deck. We've got some of that in maintenance, I think. John Golia, many of you know, I know, is a prominent figure in terms of maintenance human factors in the U.S., but we start looking at ground and airport operations, some of these other areas. We don't have that person out there sort of as champion really driving some of these programs in the same way. And that was such, I think, a vital, critical part of the success of CRM very, very early on. You had some high-profile folks who immediately bought into it and were out there pushing for it. So I think there are some limitations to, you know, training as a tool. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. One of the nice things about threat and air management, though, is it lends itself, the model lends itself very nicely to structured observation and assessment, which is another huge tool in your toolbox. And that specifically is around LOSA, Line Operations Safety Audit. And many of you are familiar with this and maybe new to some of the others. This is really a health check of your operation. It's a snapshot, looks at your operation on a routine basis, with a very, very structured and highly trained observational methodology. And it evaluates threats that your crews encounter every day under routine conditions in the operation, whether it's weather, air traffic, whatever it might be. It also, so it evaluates and measures what are the threats that you see out there every day, and then what errors occur as a result of that, and at what rate. And then continuing on the model, are those errors trapped? And if not, do they result in an undesired aircraft state? So it follows the model all the way through and provides them. I would tell you, as a safety officer, we ran our first LOSA in 2008, and when I got the report, it is probably the single most valuable report I've ever seen on certainly the quality of our operation out there. It's tremendously useful. And it's a great way to supplement your other safety programs, again, in terms of the quality of the data that you get, and in terms of both the risks that are out there and the errors that are occurring. So just very quickly, the methodology, it's run through the LOSA Collaborative, which is used to be part of the University of Texas Aerospace Crew Research Program, which is gone now when Dr. Helmreich retired. But the LOSA Collaborative is its own company now, headed up by James Klenk. What they do is they train a set of internal observers, typically pilots, your own pilots. We had some safety folks as well, and they bring in a couple of external observers. They go through very intensive training. It's 2 to 3 full days, and then there is a calibration period after that where you actually go out and do some sample observations, and they're able to calibrate the variety of observers that you're working with. You choose a representative sample of flights based on what it is that you want to look at, whether it's your entire system, maybe it's one fleet, maybe it's one region of your operation, whatever it might be. You choose a representative sample of flights, and this is what's really important. All the data are collected, sent, analyzed, and reported by the LOSA Collaborative. Management has no role in that, and that brings a tremendous amount of credibility to the final report, because you don't have an opportunity to shape it. It is what it is. And then the report builds profiles around what your threats look like, what errors your crews are committing, what undesired aircraft states those errors result in, and then how effective your countermeasures are, again, based on crew observations. So I give you a sense, and this is kind of real data. I'm not going to show you the detailed. I do have a report, though, if no one's seen one and would like to. It's said it's an amazing report. What they found in our operation is that threat profile was normal, and they've done, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 airlines around the world, so a fairly good archival database. But we found that 95% of our flights encounter at least one threat, and I don't know if that's surprising to you or not, but again, that's fairly normal, and an average of 3.6 threats per flight. So again, whether that's higher or lower than you might have thought, great data, and again, in line with what they've observed other places. The major threats that we see, and as a New York-based operator, if you've flown in and out of New York, it's probably no great surprise to you. First of all, ground and ramp operations significant to us. We were in a 50-year-old terminal. We've since moved into a brand new terminal, but the congestion and just the environment there are very, very challenging. We tend to be a quick turn airline. We have turns down to as little as 35 or 40 minutes in some of our segments. So operational pressures are significant. Crews trying to do the pre-departure checklists, do all their paperwork, constantly getting interrupted for a variety of reasons, which created a very extensive kind of action list that we worked through with airports and other sort of non-flight areas, because significant. Again, systems perspective here, okay? What we're changing, or what we're seeing in the cockpit, that changes our procedures outside the cockpit fairly dramatically in terms of what we interrupt the crew with and what we approach the crew about. And then a very, very challenging air traffic environment. Again, if you phone in New York, this is no surprise to you, but the single most common type of threat that we saw on across our flights was air traffic control issues pop up almost every flight in and out of New York. Okay. So you sort of going back, we just think about traditional safety programs. It is very much like whack-a-mole, and I imagine most of you are familiar with this game. These little moles pop up out of the holes in some random sequence. You have no idea. And the idea is, it's a little hard to see, but he's got a big foam hammer in his hand, and you smack a mole every time it pops up, and the more moles just smack, the more points you get. But it's actually kind of a nice sort of analogy for how we kind of traditionally manage safety. An issue pops up and we smack it down with some solution. Could be training, it could be something else, but you sort of wait for the mole to pop up and then we smack it down. That's sort of the reactive level that that Jim talked about earlier today. Well, what we obviously need are more and better tools that are more diagnostic, allow us to predict where the mole is going to pop up. And in having those, then we can more effectively tailor our training programs to those issues that either are prevalent or we know are coming as the operation changes or as the environment changes in some way. So that's really the key, is to have that sort of suite of tools that become more diagnostic and more predictive than traditionally we have had. And that's really what this whole notion of safety management systems is designed to help us do. Again, it's an ICAO standard out there. The U.S. is working through right now. What does that mean in terms of regulation? What does it look like, et cetera? But in the U.S., it, you know, identifies sort of four pillars of safety management systems. The first one is safety policy. And you can see the attributes that line up underneath that. But it's really about what is the commitment of the organization to the front line and vice versa in terms of managing safety on a day-to-day basis, what resources are in place. And this is where the Just Culture initiatives that we've talked so much about today, this is where they would all fall, as well as things like contingency planning, emergency response, and process evaluations. Next area is risk management. This is hazard identification. And again, we've seen a couple of examples of that, certainly. But this is where your risk assessment lies. This is your safety reporting programs, ASAP. For those of you not familiar with ASAP, it's I call it safety reporting on steroids, but it's the opportunity for frontline folks to report even regulatory violations, and in exchange for full and open disclosure, receive some incentives against enforcement or disciplinary policy. Now, that's where your investigations live, and the safety report, safety review boards that, again, others have talked about, fall within this pillar. Safety assurance, these are basically your safety programs that ensure that you maintain a certain standard of safety or quality through the organization. Again, this is where FOQA, other flight data monitoring programs might live. LOSA certainly falls under this. This is your temperature check or your health monitoring of the system. This is where these programs would lie. And then the final area is safety promotion, and this is where training really resides, you know, where you're out there, again, establishing the standard, communicating that, and recognizing performance positively and negatively, driving accountability around that. Most, I think, good operators, most major operators have some or all of these things. What we have not done is integrated these programs, and again, number of speakers have talked about that. That's really the challenge going forward, and that's really where we start to maximize our training programs. And every one of these programs, to the extent that we can integrate these various sources of information in meaningful ways, allow us to predict where the threats are and evaluate the effectiveness of our mitigation strategies. That's where the real gains in training and other programs will come from. So in conclusion, I think early on, the human factors training as a solution, training this area, was fairly easily justifiable because of the accident rate and the fact that these soft skills were nowhere part of the curriculum of standard pilot. Okay, so there was a need, and you couldn't go get it anywhere else. We had to create the training around these types of skills. Now, more recently, with threat and error management training, other types of human factors training, we're able to sort of move those concepts out of the training world and start to evaluate them, measure them very systematically, and it provides a good basis for risk assessment and, again, measuring the effectiveness of our mitigation strategies. And then just concluding point, you know, that training really has to be part of the overall safety management system, working together with these other programs, and to that extent, all of those programs will become better. But that's a huge challenge for us. I don't think any one of us does that really, really well. I've seen some great examples, and that's what makes the value of this kind of meeting so important. Even working across industries into rail and airline, we don't have it figured out yet. And you guys are going to, you know, rail and other modes are going to come up with solutions that will help us. And so having the opportunity to share what's working and what's not working across domains will make us all better. So thanks for your time.